Blood in the sand in Bahrain, and not for the first time. Saudi armour rolls in, protesters die. The same Saudi Arabia, soon to be bombing Libya, in defence of democracy. In Libya, there's a green light for bombs away, as well as a no-fly zone. But the Libyans have just accepted the resolution. Is the West at war with the Arabs? Is it just that they can't help it? And in Japan, tens of thousands are dead or missing after the earthquake and tsunami. But with the nuclear plants fractured and leaking, could that be just the tip of the iceberg? We'll debate all of this and more, I promise you, in The Real Deal.
Ow, just the way you move, it's a real deal. And the way you groove, oh, it's the way I feel, yeah. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Got me crazy about the way you are. So I'm a deal, baby, you're the real deal.
Welcome to The Real Deal with me, George Galloway. Every week at this time, I'm here at Press TV in central London, bringing you the news and views you just won't find in the corporate media. Shooting from the hip and shooting from the lip, as always, but you could fire back at me, at least by email, to realdeal@presstv.co.uk. I'm just back from a short tour of the United States and Canada. Canada still bears the imprints of its Scottish heritage in the names of the towns and of the people, although the immigration which developed it has long ago been diluted by the subsequent waves of people to the New World, many of them now from Arabia. In Scotland, there's been much tumult about the behaviour in the football match between Celtic and Rangers, many of whose supporters continue to resent the Catholic Irish immigration which gave birth to Celtic. Their two managers got a little bit upset with each other. In Canada, though, the current debate centres on their national game, but on an altogether more serious issue, about whether ice hockey players should be able to hit each other around the head with their sticks. Now, I thought that was illegal, and it probably is, but it's a hot topic. Now, that's a real controversy. I spoke in Calgary and launched Viva Palestina Canada, and in Toronto, in both places, to large crowds, then to New York, to another large crowd, a kind of celebration about me starting last Wednesday my weekly radio show on New York City's WBAI Pacifica radio station. You can catch the show on 99.5 FM, if you're in the tri-state area. It's at 9 a.m. local time every Wednesday, or online live or retrospectively at www.wbai.org. But if ice hockey is brutal in Canada, politics is just as brutal south of the border. The poll numbers for prospective Republican presidential candidate Sarah Palin are a severe blow to the head for her hopes. So far in 2011, she's down in South Dakota, down in South Carolina, down in Arizona, only up by 1 point in Texas, by the same in Nebraska, just to pick a few out. But the worst possible news for the worst possible candidate is that independent voters say they would support party-loving Charlie Sheen over Palin for president by a 41-36 margin. Seriously, Charlie Sheen for president. Now there's a thought. His father, of course, has already been there. Actor in The West Wing, although Charlie might find it difficult campaigning from rehab, which is where he should be, but isn't. The US military is developing software that will let it secretly manipulate social media sites, such as Facebook and Twitter, by using fake online personas, what they call sock puppets, apparently. This to influence internet conversations and spread pro-American propaganda. I think they'll find that a difficult job, however many sock puppets they have. A Californian corporation has been awarded the contract. This cheating farce, part of General David Petraeus's PSYOPs campaign, is aimed apparently at the Middle East and Central Asia. It will allow one US serviceman or woman to control up to 10 separate identities based all over the world. Isn't that what paedophiles do to groom victims? Later in the programme, I'll be talking with an Icelandic MP whose real online persona and details are being attacked by the same US government. Too little, too late, too much, too little, too late anyway. And what's the result of the Libyans accepting the UN Security Council resolution, which Britain and France, the Sykes and Picot of international relations, had been promoting? It allows a bombs away as well as a no-fly zone in Libya. allows everything, actually, except boots on the ground, but only in defense of civilians, and only if Colonel Gaddafi didn't accept a ceasefire. Now that he has, it's going to be difficult to work out what happens next. Now, I want to see Gaddafi brought down just as much as the next hawk or armchair general. But as you've heard me say 10,000 times before, I don't believe that hypocritical armed intervention in the affairs of some other countries, though not others, or indeed the intervention in other countries in the opposite direction, is really going to help us go forward. Here's how The Guardian's Steve Bell saw it, brilliantly, as usual. The tanks and armored personnel carriers and soldiers moved into Bahrain during the week to crush the rebellion against the nasty little despotism who have ruled the tiny country for over 200 years. The cousin of a friend of mine was killed by these invaders on the first day. My country, as it has throughout the world, helped to prop up this dictatorship. We gave them, amongst many other things, the man known as the Butcher of Bahrain, Ian Henderson. Henderson might have walked from the fevered pages of a Graham Greene novel, I Told Parliament, 15 years ago. He was an interrogator of Mau Mau prisoners during colonial rule in Kenya, when the Kenyans were fighting a bitter struggle for the freedom of their country. So brutally efficient were his methods that on obtaining independence for Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta first tried to re-engage him in his own security apparatus. But so notorious was Henderson that a big demonstration was mounted by his victims, and the whole affair became so scandalous that Kenyatta was forced to deport him via Ian Smith's whites-only Rhodesia. He then became torturer-in-chief in Bahrain, until a long campaign, in which I like to think I was instrumental, forced the Bahraini royal family to ask him to go to a well-feathered retiral in the south of England, to a cottage known as Dun Torturing. Actually, he's now back in Manama, where clashes continue in the capital, but not on the same scale as the pitched battles earlier in the week. How could it be? There are now thousands of foreign soldiers on the streets. The tragedy, no, the scandal of the devastation in Japan, though, continues. Tens of thousands dead, and after the earthquake and the tsunami, nuclear reactors on the point of meltdown, maybe, releasing clouds of radioactive steam into the atmosphere. I spoke to Malcolm Grimston, a nuclear expert from the Research Institute Chatham House. We talked earlier today. Baby, you're the real deal, yeah. Malcolm, welcome to the Real Deal. What I think we need for our worldwide audience are some layman's terms, because a lot of this science is blinding to many of us, I can assure you. We know there was an earthquake off Japan. What happened next so far as these nuclear plants was concerned?
Well, it started off okay. The fission processes that produced most of the heat for making steam shut off as they should. You then need to get water circulating over what's left of the fuel to keep it cool for several days so it doesn't melt. They lost power to those pumps, but they've got backup diesel generators. All that was fine. Then the tsunami hit, and the tsunami drowned the diesel generators. They stopped working. So they were then left with the fuel inside what they call the core of the reactor getting hot. That began to boil the water that was in there.
Let me stop you there. You say getting hot. Even though it's switched off, it continues to get hot?
That's right, because the fuel in the nuclear reactor has what are called fission products. These are the fragments of atoms that are left after the atoms are split in the process. Those are extremely hot, although not for terribly long, and extremely radioactive, though not for terribly long. So you need to keep them cool with water flowing over them for a matter of days until the worst of that heat has died away, and then you're in what's called cold shutdown, you're safe. However, having lost all of the power supply to the pumps that keep that water flowing, we now had the water inside the core of the reactor, which is a very thick steel vessel, starting to boil. Some of the water began to react with the metal cans of the fuel. That produces a gas called hydrogen. And also some of the radioactive material in the cans started to escape into the inner pressure vessel. Now, you can't let pressure build up in there too much, because then it could start to risk breaking in some way. So they had to release the mixture of gases within the centre of the reactor. That let hydrogen out, and those explosions that we saw were that hydrogen exploding with air. They weren't actually, in any sense, nuclear explosions. But because there was also some radioactive material mixed in, that then escaped to the environment. The real challenge for the plant is getting enough water into the middle of those reactors to keep them cool. If they don't do that, the fuel could melt. It could melt its way out of the steel vessel. That certainly hasn't happened yet. But then you would get very significant amounts of radioactive material escape.
When you say very significant, especially in Japan, the place where the only two nuclear weapons fired in anger were fired, are we talking about as serious as a nuclear bomb explosion?
Certainly not. The nuclear reactors can't explode like nuclear bombs, and the physics demonstrates that. Even Chernobyl, which was, I think, by far more serious than this, clearly wasn't an atomic explosion in that sense, because what was left of the plant, an atomic explosion flattens everything for many miles. Nonetheless, the levels of activity released are certainly of a serious concern to the health of the workers on the site. Because they evacuated people away, certainly the levels we've seen so far, and probably quite a lot higher, would not cause any health problems, significant health problems for people off-site. But absolutely, as you say, there is a particular fear of radioactive materials in Japan because of their experience with the atomic weapons.
Now, many will be surprised to hear you say that what's happened in Japan is not nearly as serious as what happened in Chernobyl. Of course, I take your word for that. You're the expert. And that must be a function of how long ago Chernobyl was and how much more television has developed, so that we are now 24/7 watching this scene of doom, apparently, in Japan, and we kind of scarcely remember any good pictures from Chernobyl. Compare the two, would you? Chernobyl with Japan 2011.
I think there are two key differences. First, the Chernobyl accident happened when the plant was still operating. In fact, because of a design flaw that was unique to that particular type of reactor, which was only ever built in the former Soviet Union, the power could run away with itself instead of shutting itself down naturally, which is what did happen at Fukushima. So that meant the plant was actually generating about 500 times its normal operating power at the point of the accident. That's what caused the accident. That meant you had an enormous explosion right at the centre of the vessel. There were actually lumps of fuel found more than 100 metres away from the site, and a massive blast that sent the material up into the atmosphere. Here, we're already a week after those processes shut down. The radioactivity in the fuel is now only about a hundredth of what it was at the time of the accident. And there is no, even if we get to the worst case of it melting through, there is no upward force like the explosion at Chernobyl to throw the stuff out into the atmosphere.
And yet, as far away as Tokyo, people are queuing for hours, days, to get out of the country for fear of the radioactivity reaching the capital city. And having just a few hours ago returned from the United States, I can tell you that on the west coast of the United States, there are people who are afraid that the radioactivity is going to cross the entire Pacific Ocean and affect them. Are these people simply panicking unnecessarily?
I don't believe those are realistic threats at all. In Tokyo, there have been measurements that have shown some radioactive material, but of course we get a considerable amount of radiation from the natural environment each year, and we've evolved with that level of radiation. Small amounts of radiation don't have any measurable long-term health effects whatsoever, and the amounts that are possible at Tokyo, 150 miles away, even in the worst-case scenario, are extremely unlikely to ever cause any detectable health effects in the long term. Having said that, the golden rule with radiation is you don't get any dose if you can avoid it. So there has to be a positive benefit to the activity causing the dose. And if you do get a dose, it has to be kept as low as possible, and you must never go against dose limits. So people who have no particular reason to stay in Tokyo, it's perfectly sensible that they should move away. I have to say, if I was in Tokyo, I would not be personally be worried as the things have turned out so far, or even if things were to get significantly worse.
And in California, no chance at all?
I think that's simply unrealistic to believe that there's any potential there for any damage.
What does all this mean then? You're an expert in these nuclear matters. Is it the end for nuclear power? Are people going to be so spooked and frightened by all of this, even though you've explained it rather well, that the politicians in democratic countries, at least, are simply going to be unable to go further down the nuclear route?
Very difficult to answer that. We've already seen in Germany, where there is an election looming, that the government has taken steps for some of their older nuclear power stations. On the other hand, in France and the United States, the statements that are being made are very different. Nuclear power is not built because it is safe. It's built because it provides reliable electricity that doesn't generate greenhouse gases and doesn't leave us dependent on exports of oil and gas from the very unstable at present political region of the Middle East and the former Soviet Union. It's certainly not just a great big executive toy that people enjoy having. Those arguments haven't changed. The United Kingdom needs to build an awful lot of power stations of some description in the next 10 years. We either become very dependent on imported gas, we use coal, which has climate change implications. Renewables certainly have a greater part to play, but we can't be sure the wind's going to be blowing or the tide's going to be in or the sun's going to be out at the moment we need the electricity. Nuclear can provide reliable baseload electricity for keeping our water supplies clean, for running our essential transport systems, for providing medical care and so on. Incidentally, things that are in enormous demand in Japan at this moment. There's no easy answers around energy, but I think the fundamental reason that nuclear power has very much swung back into the equation over the last 5 years have not been dramatically changed by what's happening at the moment. Having said that, it would be very foolish if we didn't look very carefully to see if there are any lessons to be learnt from this and apply those lessons.
And one must be not to build so many nuclear plants near earthquake zones.
Well, the irony is it wasn't the earthquake, it was the tsunami, the earthquake itself. And there's a plant at Onagawa, which is a much more modern plant, which was one of the closest man-made structures to the earthquake and the tsunami, which they closed down perfectly, happily, and is just fine with that. This is, after all, 1960s technology at Fukushima. The first plant began generating in 1970, only 14 years after the very first nuclear power station in the world. So this isn't modern technology. New plants built today have a very different approach to safety.
Malcolm, that's been very helpful indeed. Thanks for joining us and spreading some light on the heated subject of the nuclear disaster in Japan. There's more coming up on the show from Iceland after this.
Ow! Just the way you move, it's a real deal. And the way you groove, oh, it's the way I feel, yeah, yeah. You're a wild thing and you're a natural star. Got me crazy about the way you are. So I want you, baby, you're the real deal, yeah.
On the line now from Iceland is the most prominent Icelandic Member of Parliament, activist and all-round good egg, Birgitta Jónsdóttir. Birgitta, welcome again to The Real Deal. You have been in trouble, I suppose, with the American courts in the last week, where they have decided that your Twittering and your Facebooking and your emails are all their property, or at least they're entitled to read them all. Tell us what that's all about.
Well, because I co-produced the video titled Collateral Murder, with the Apache helicopter video killing civilians and reporters in Iraq. And I put my name out there as a co-producer, and I was an active volunteer for WikiLeaks. They apparently think that they can send out their fishing nets for trying to get information to charge Julian Assange for spying, which is, of course, very far-fetched. And it also explains why they are treating Bradley Manning the way they're doing, because they're trying to break him down. Needless to say that he's been in solitary confinement for nearly 10 months now, and he just turned 23. So I am actually very glad that the US authorities decided to go after my information to raise awareness about the situation when it comes to your right as a user on social media in the United States. And your right is basically, according to the judge ruling last week, your right is very limited. You do not have the right to defend yourself as an individual. You have to rely on either Twitter, Facebook, or Google if authorities want to pry into your information. And it is quite common. The only reason I got to know about that this court in Virginia was requesting my information was because Twitter decided to fight on behalf of me and the others. We were actually five that they requested information from. But originally, they requested to get this information from Twitter without our knowledge within 3 days. So I'm actually very happy with the way Twitter handled this. But I haven't heard anything from either Facebook or Google, and obviously Twitter information is much less relevant than all the information you have on Facebook and on Google.
Well, I mean, that's globalization, isn't it? You are an Icelandic citizen, a citizen of the European Union, you're an elected member of parliament, and Facebook and Twitter and Google have personal contractual relations with you, which are presumably legally protected, but the American government, just by virtue of the fact that these companies are headquartered in the United States, can order through the courts the books to be open, your personal mail to be open, and whilst, as you say, your tweeting won't be particularly profound, no Twitter is, but when they get into your emails, of course, all of your rights are being violated.
Yes, and obviously I don't have a proof for that yet. I'm trying to find out just through my lawyers if we can get through the legal system information if they requested that information. There apparently, according to the ruling, this is a case, there are some documents in relation to me through a grand jury, which they can't get, my lawyers. So it's quite a mysterious case. And
well, it's part, though, of a bigger picture, as you yourself said. There's a witch hunt against Julian Assange. Bradley Manning, a 23-year-old military man, is being treated worse than any Guantanamo Bay inmate. And now you, an Icelandic member of parliament, because of your connection to WikiLeaks, whistleblowing, telling the truth to the world about atrocities, the US state, even under that nice man, President Barack Obama, is bearing down on you all.
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because of all the promises both him and Hillary have made about both of Guantanamo Bay, but also about transparency and the right to express yourself and the freedom of information, but it appears it only is the right for a selected few. And I think it is, we're at a very critical time right now when it comes to freedom of information, and I really urge everybody that are watching this show to make themselves aware of the fact that when you write an email, whenever you create contacts on Facebook, that can be a subject of governments to try to criminalize you if you are an activist, for example. So I think it is very, very important that we make ourselves aware of it. And then it is, of course, time to call for action. And I think that we need to demand, as users of social media in the United States, that the conditions that or the rights that we sign off when we join these medias should be either reinstalled, as you know, I want to be able to defend myself. And actually, in my case, it is very, very interesting, and it actually opened up a whole Pandora's box, because I'm not only a member of parliament, I'm also in the Foreign Affairs Committee, and I'm in the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And this issue has actually been discussed twice at the IPU, the International Parliamentary Union, and they're writing a report on it that will be presented in April.
Because I'll tell you one thing, Birgitta. Apart from anything else, they're definitely making you famous throughout the world. And for the best of reasons, I wish you every success in your upcoming battles. I'm sure we'll link up again in the future. Once more, time has beaten us. As ever, though, until we meet again, I've been George Galloway. This has been The Real Deal on Press TV, and you've been a marvellous audience.
baby, you're the real deal.